Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you on this Thursday morning. It is the 5th of September, and we thank you very much for taking the time out and to let us be a part of your morning. And as we try to figure out what is happening in the world, music we just heard is Goose. Goose is playing at SPAC on tomorrow night and then on Saturday night. Two nights of Goose, or as Mike Bowen said, Deuce Goose.
Geese.
Pretty good. Right, yes. Geese. Geese.
Are they from Canada?
SPAC.org for more information, SPAC.org, and they'll be at SPAC on Friday and Saturday nights. Goose playing SPAC and playing our music going into our break. So we thank you all for being with us this morning. And let me introduce our group to you, and then we'll get started on the news of the day. Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia DeMont is here. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. It's the first week of class.
How did it go? How is it going?
So far, so good. We start on Monday. We don't do Labor Day like a lot of colleges and universities. Yeah. It's like we try to get the full weekend. So it's got lots of students on campus and having a good time.
They're showing up.
Yep.
They're getting ready.
Mm-hmm.
Learning the ropes.
Yep.
Good for them. Excellent. The Ulster County Controller and former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, is here. Hello, March.
Good morning. Happy to be here. Actually, honored to be here. I wanted to say that. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on the airwaves with you guys and to meet so many great people. And it's a beautiful morning. These September mornings have been absolutely stunning, making me really happy to be alive. And I just want to note that we lost somebody really important in the Ulster County community this week, Julie Novak, who died of cancer. These sunny, bright mornings are making me think about how lucky we are to be here.
Very sad, and very nice to think of her this morning. Mark Whitman is with us. He is a Wall Street investment banker, a dear friend. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Morning, Joe. I'm good. School being back in session is meaningful in our home, not only because my son's about to go back, but my wife's a college professor. I will say I was at Ground Zero on 9/11, and so sunny, clear September days still carry a particular pang for me.
Yeah.
I understand that.
Yeah. You know, it's how quick it can change, and it's right, of what else is happening. It's a very good point. Well, we have a lot to talk about today, and even about things that can happen on beautiful days that we did not expect when we got up in the morning. We welcome everyone to be a part of the program. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let's go to, of course, what I'm referring to, and that is the Georgia high school shooting that took place yesterday. There are details, not a lot, but we know some things. What we know, though, at the core level of this, and I'm probably going to harp on this a lot this morning, but a 14-year-old student, 14 years old, accused of killing four people with a military-style rifle at his Georgia high school. And they questioned him about online threats when he was 13, according to the FBI. Nine people were expected to survive their injuries. Four were killed yesterday, barely a month into the new school year. The student opened fire with a military-style rifle on Wednesday at the Appalachie High in Winder, Georgia, killing two students and two teachers. He surrendered when confronted by school resource officers, according to the authorities, who said the suspect would be charged with murder. Students described their terror as a lockdown that they initially thought was a drill. It turned out to be anything but. They said they heard gunfire and barricaded themselves in classrooms, then later fled to the football field to reunite with anxious parents. The attack, which also injured 8 students and a teacher, stoked fear and anguish in the city of roughly 18,000 people in the exurbs of Atlanta, as the community grappled with a burst of violence that the local sheriff described as pure evil. I would like to get back to that in just a moment. I would like to say that the 14-year-old suspect, Colt Gray, will be prosecuted as an adult, according to the director of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, who said that the shooter had used an AR platform-style weapon. The authorities were still investigating how he had gained access to the gun. Rifles based on the AR-15 design have been commonly used in mass shootings. It's hard for me. I was listening to the sheriff yesterday during the press conference that they gave in the afternoon, the early afternoon, well, late afternoon, but it was the first press conference that they gave. And the sheriff said this was pure evil and this kid was pure evil. He's 13 years old. I'm sorry, but...
It's blaming a person when we really need to be blaming a system.
We have to blame a system, and we have to blame... There's a lot of things, but what led a 13-year-old kid to do this? And I think that's what we have to figure out instead of taking this kid and making him out to be, quote, pure evil. I believe there was a statement about that he went before the school resources officers, and he knew whether if he went any further that he would go to hell. Okay, we don't know that, obviously. At the end of the day, he committed murder, and a murder of 2 students, 2 teachers, and a lot of injuries. And I certainly don't excuse that in any way, shape, or form. However, I think we have to obviously look at it in a larger picture of how we look at a personification of evil. Mark.
Well, Joe, I think you're right to highlight that pronouncement by the sheriff, because if you centralize the problem in one person, then you can solve it. And once you've solved it, tried him as an adult, you're done with it. It reminds me a lot of what Ted Cruz said after Uvalde. We said, well, you know, you don't have to have gun control. You just need to harden all the schools, have one entrance, and put a security guard, and we're done. As if that would protect all Americans, let alone even all children, from gun violence. The question of what led the child to want to do this is one question. The question of why was he able to do it is easily answered, because we as a society permitted him to have access to a weapon like an AR platform weapon, whatever we're calling them now. And I'll tell you an interesting story, and then I'll pass along for others to comment. I was touring schools. My son has recently changed schools. Someday we can talk about why it is his previous school couldn't protect him from racism, but that's a whole different question. And as part of the interview, at the end of the interview at one particular school, I asked the school administrator, was there any question I haven't asked that parents normally do? And she looked at me and she said, well, I want to be polite because you're a little bit of an older adult, so maybe this is a generational issue. But all of the parents now ask about active shooter safety drills and procedures. That's how pervasive this, and even in some ways even more importantly, the fear of it, has become in our country now.
It's how pervasive, and there was video that was taken by students and I believe one teacher of cell phone video as they were marching out to the football field yesterday. And at one point they said, oh, this is the 5th time we've done this. Obviously not under the circumstances, but as a drill in the past, which is, very, obviously very telling
And it seems early on in these investigations, everyone seems to say, well, things worked out exactly the way we wanted them to. And then over the next 2 or 3 weeks, all we do is say, this went wrong, that went wrong, this went wrong, that went wrong. So I'm not going to do that today, but we'll see what the investigation holds. Malia.
I think one of the things that this demonstrates is how difficult it is under our current system to prevent a mass shooting. So this kid, when he was 13, was interviewed by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. They came into the house. They interviewed the kid and the father. Apparently, the father assured the Georgia Bureau of Investigation that the weapons were secured. The child didn't have access to them. And despite that, and obviously that means this child was on law enforcement's radar. He had made threats. They knew he had access to a weapon, even though the parent said he didn't. And despite all that, this tragedy still occurred because, as we heard in the press conference yesterday, there was, I think it was the sheriff who said, there was no probable cause to take any further action beyond the interview they held with him. So they're watching him. They're aware that there's some kind of issue, and they're not able to stop it under our current laws. So that it makes you wonder how many other kids are under surveillance because they've made threats it's really disheartening to say the least. I would be surprised, based on what we heard yesterday, if the father doesn't end up being charged in some way, because obviously he said that he was safeguarding these weapons and wasn't allowing access, and yet the kid ended up with the weapon. So there is some trend of holding parents now responsible for the actions of their children, their minor children. I don't know if this is the first time that someone is going to be charged as an adult in that kind of circumstance, but I imagine the father is going to see some kind of charges as well.
You know, I just also, and I want to get to March, obviously, but it is this idea of the school resource officer, and I understand that, and they're the pro-gun side of this discussion that says, well, you take care of the gun problem with guns. I mean, so better would have been a school resource officer killing a 14-year-old? I mean, good God.
Right.
Is that what we've...
that would be traumatizing as well.
Again, I am not by any way excusing the horrific crimes of this 14-year-old kid. However, an eye for an eye when it comes to taking a school resource officer who has to look into the face of a 14-year-old and take him down, I don't know how that works.
In our county, school resource officers are contracted through the sheriff's office. So it's sheriff's deputies that are our school resource officers in most districts. I think the parents being held responsible is where we're going. I agree with Malia on this, and I'm glad to think about it that way. I think they should be. I think parents need to think of themselves on the front line. If you have a child who has real mental health issues and is suffering from depression and anger, it is your responsibility to get your kid help. And it certainly is your responsibility to secure any weapons that you have. What I'm outraged about is we are still having this conversation. I'm so done with this topic. It's like repeat, you know, mass shooting at a school, AR-15, and then people piling on, you know, gun advocates, Second Amendment advocates piling on, saying it's not the time to talk about policies. And Governor Kemp from Georgia said that yesterday. I'm sorry, it is. I disagree with the governor of Georgia. And I just want to note, you know, like the Gifford Center, you know, that's Gabby Gifford's nonprofit that fights gun violence, ranked Georgia as like the 46th worst state in the country for I should say, one of the worst, one of the worst in the state for gun issues. And he said he wears that as a badge of honor. This is several years ago. So, you know, we have leaders who are accepting this, who are condoning it, and who are then chastising the rest of us for trying to bring solutions to the table when something happens. And that's outrageous.
And do we have to go to break?
You have a half a minute. Go ahead.
I worry about the kids, unlike in a workplace shooting where, you know, you can work from home sort of indefinitely after that. The kids are going to have to go back into the school. And it's just psychologically traumatizing for them that there are very few other options to help them continue their education. And I don't think we've really dealt with that.
There was a child on that was being interviewed last night who said, well, I guess we're going back to school on Monday, I think. We can't go back tomorrow because it's an active crime scene. I mean, my God. And I mean, obviously the kids have to go back to school sometime, but I think we have to work on some of the trauma aspects
right.
of this as well before we bring it all together. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your comments, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We're going to take a break and hear news from the BBC. And when we come back, we'll continue with Malia DeMont, March Gallagher, and Mark Whitman, and your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion, and we welcome you. We have March Gallagher, Malia DeMont, and Mark Whitman with us. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We are talking about a 14-year-old who brought in an AR platform-style weapon into school in Georgia. Four people killed, two students, two teachers, and many, many others injured. The shooting was the deadliest episode of school violence in Georgia history, prompted an outpouring of sympathy and outrage. President Biden, in a statement, lamented the attack as another horrific reminder of how gun violence continues to tear our communities apart. We do have letters. Let's get to some of those. So, let me go backwards in the sense of letters that came in first. All right. Byron, why is that our criminal justice, and that's a joke, wants to charge a child who has no sense of who he is yet and certainly is not developed as an adult? To charge him as an adult is wrong. It is cruel. It is unfair. The parents were asleep at the wheel and let their son crash while taking others down with him. That from Byron.
I mean, one of the reasons for charging as an adult is to get harsher consequences, right? Let's be clear. There's outcomes here. That's why they're doing it.
Right. But to the point, is that fair to a 14-year-old who, you know, may or may not have even gone through puberty yet?
I don't think we've heard in any of the reports whether this child, Colt Gray, I guess
yes.
is his name, got any mental health counseling or anything like that. Like, that hasn't been part of what has been emphasized in the reports about this since the FBI, not the FBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation visited him last year. Like, what has happened in the interim to help?
I was confused on that. I'm sorry, Mark. I was confused on that because the FBI reported that, but you're right. It was the Georgia Bureau mm-hmm. that had red flagged it.
Right.
Last year.
I think they're the ones who spoke with him and the parent.
And then the FBI who were giving that information out as of yesterday.
Right.
Look, to have a mass shooting in this country, you typically need a group of people, you need a firearm, and you need a disaffected, young, typically white male. So you're not going to stop groups of people getting together. Even if we stop minting guns today, it'd be 100 years before they'd all get so old, they come off the streets. So that's not going to happen. You know, I know it's cliche to say we need to worry about mental health, but what's the harm of making sure that more of these disaffected young white males, particularly those who have an initial brush with the law around threats or threats of using firearms or threats of violence, what's the harm of making sure that they get better care?
Like, what else happened? The GBI is like, we flagged him, we couldn't arrest him. There was no probable cause to arrest him. And so, like, and that's the end of the story until the shooting happened? I mean, it's...
Right. We don't know. We don't know yet what the investigation will turn up. But this is the 385th mass shooting this year in the United States. That's 1.5 mass shootings a day. Not school related. School related, 32 school related in K-12 campuses and 13 on university and college campuses. That's just school shootings in general, not necessarily mass. So it's a huge problem everywhere. I'm overwhelmed that we haven't crafted not just one solution, but like a multitude of policy initiatives on this.
And the thing that seems obvious to me is you have to have insurance when you have a car. When they mint one of these guns, they should start to form an insurance fund. And if you want to have the insurance be a one-time when the first buyer has to pay it or it's an ongoing obligation, I don't care. But at a minimum, when these things happen, we as a public should have the wherewithal to go into that school, provide everybody the necessary counseling, clean up, and do the best we can. You know, even for the parents of the deceased, obviously you can't bring people back. But 20 years on, when somebody asks an individual who witnessed or was part of the community, gee, how do you feel about it? And they say, look, we can never get the loss back, but at least we took care of everything else that we could. We're not even in that position in this country.
Richard writes, please recant the statement blaming the individual as opposed to blaming the system. I say, please blame the individual. The kid was obviously smart enough to evade the FBI's inquiries and smart enough to get his dad's gun. Blame him and the parents. Treat him as an adult and set a new precedent with the death penalty. I don't know what good that does. I understand your point. But I also don't know if you blame the individual. Yes, of course. I mean, he's the one who's going to be charged. So, yes, he's being blamed. That does make sense. So I don't think we're not saying that. But there is a system to be blamed, or we wouldn't have the number that March just read of how many of these shootings we have in our country in just a year's time.
Well, the other option is to just put a loaded firearm by the bedside of every 14-year-old and have them act on impulse and just blame them when it happens. I mean, the letter writers, I mean, I'm obviously making an extreme point. It's silly. It's this society that gave him access to that gun, and if you don't believe it, just look across the ocean to the United Kingdom, where if he had those impulses, he'd be lucky to get a hold of a knife of a certain length, which are also illegal to carry in the UK on the street.
I'm the one who commented on the system, blame the system, not the individual, and I'm not saying don't blame the individual. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying as we look to solutions, we have to look broader than just pointing a finger at one child and saying that they're evil. We have to look at the entire system.
Well, the student is being charged, and the kid will be charged with murder. I mean, so whether he's charged as an adult or as a minor, still going to be charged with murder.
And death penalty wise, I'm just not here for it. Why do we kill people who kill people to show that killing people is wrong? I can't get behind it.
And exactly. There's also a PS to that letter, which was, and I unfortunately clicked off of it, so I don't have it right in front of me. But the PS was that the school officer did not have to shoot and kill the student. He could have just injured the student, but my understanding is law enforcement is to shoot to kill.
Yeah,
right?
Well, that speaks of it. The writer, the letter writer, should go educate themselves about a lot of things, including the use of lethal force. No one who shoots a firearm is so good that they can reliably wound but not kill, which is why when you tell law enforcement or people who are rightfully defending themselves with a firearm, if you got to use it, hit the body mass so that you can solve the problem, because trying to nick an ear is not a reasonable technique.
I'm eating a donut.
Okay. You caught me. I thought you were going to go off longer.
Joe, I was horrified to read accounts of parents who rushed to the scene and couldn't, because of the traffic being stopped and roads being closed, couldn't get there, had to park their cars in ditches and on the sides of the road two miles away and run to the site. And I just, my heart breaks for those parents, and just think about how that would feel here and what extreme circumstances that is for people in their day-to-day life.
Oh, and I also look, I hate to go here, but you know, my understanding is Georgia's very permissive. I think it's even an open carry state. Imagine how many parents in the wake of Uvalde now, when they hear something at a school, put the firearm in the car with them and run towards the school. Because if you had one, you'd say to yourself, I'm never letting what happened in Uvalde happen to my children.
That's a great point. Chris says, what are the proposed expresses gun policy for each presidential candidate? Well, I think we have one candidate who believes firmly in the Second Amendment and is funded to a great extent by the NRA and like organizations. And we have another candidate who has spoken out rather forcefully about...
Who has prosecuted criminals.
Gun crimes.
Yes.
And is in favor of more measures to promote gun safety. I know we talk about this topic a lot, but there are things I just want to resurrect Ben Franklin and have him look at where we are on gun control and imagine him saying, well, you know, in my day we had just shed an occupying military force with single load muskets. But what you got going now isn't really what we intended. There is no way that he wouldn't laugh at the interpretation that Clarence Thomas and others have come up with, which looks far more like a scene out of a John Wayne movie than it does out of what really happened at the founding of our country.
This is Ben Franklin, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just go out. If you feel stressed, just go out and fly a kite.
I looked at
in a thunderstorm.
I looked at Fox News this morning to see, you know, what they were carrying on what Trump said, and the headline says, you know, that Trump will he responds to the massacre, pinpointing why it happened and what he'll do about it. And then when you drill down into the article, which was based on his Fox News interview, he offers zero solutions at none, zero, nothing.
All they do, as Ted Cruz proved, is just fill a blank in during the interview and then move on. Ted Cruz said after Uvalde he wants to harden all the entrances, put a security guard at the end, and then all the kids are protected from guns, apparently. Somebody should check in with him and ask how he's doing on that initiative and why that didn't stop what happened in Georgia.
Roger writes, the Attorney General of Texas is suing the Texas State Fair because they have banned firearms there. That is... gives us a sense of our culture, especially in the state of Texas. Jerry writes, the leading cause of death for children and high schoolers in the U.S. is guns. Republicans say they are pro-life, but have created and sustained this predicament with insane permissive gun laws. This should be an election issue. Anytime a conservative state says they are pro-life, point out the inaccuracy of that statement. Then we go to Barbara. Why did the state or school not provide mental health services to the child a year ago? He demonstrated he considered a mass shooting. When students show their desire to kill, we, school personnel, must help a 13-year-old and not ignore it. Again, there's a lot we don't know.
Yeah.
That may have very well been the case. We don't know. But... yeah. I mean, that's the point.
You would hope that's what happened.
You would hope that you have a year, in this case, to work with a student to try to figure out what the issues are and to keep that child safe as well as the students that he is around.
I'd like to know what kind of information he was consuming and some of these other, you know, young mass shooting culprits, because I just feel like I'm not sure what they're exposed to. And as a parent, it's hard for me to even know, you know, what should I be on the lookout for in terms of my kids and what media they're consuming, you know. So, and I'm not talking about the generalized media that most of our listeners are looking at every day. I'm talking about, you know, YouTube channels, podcasts, TikTok. You know, what was he looking at? What was inspiring him?
And I know this isn't an answer to your question, but whatever he wanted to, right? I mean, it isn't. So if there was a predilection to say, I want to look at, I want to watch videos of people leading up to a school shooting, or if I want to watch, or if I want to play a violent video game, or whatever the case may be, there's no stoppage to that.
Yeah, we know he wouldn't have been stopped from that, because presuming he got the gun and the ammunition in the house, we know that the household didn't have the simple measures of having the guns locked up with trigger locks and the ammunition locked up. I mean, so if he could get a hold of a deadly weapon, I'm thinking the YouTube filter wasn't working either.
One more letter. We'll take a break and we'll come back to more. Catherine says, what help does a parent get when they understand their child is mentally ill?
Yeah.
I'd like to know what aids are available for those with mental illness. When the Georgia Bureau of Investigations contacted the parents of a 13-year-old exhibiting serious problems and threats, did they offer assistance or guide the parents to mental health facilities, or did they just say, quote, your son is pure evil? And those are questions that really need to be asked and thought about, I think, to a greater degree. All right, we'll take a break. We have many, many more comments. We'll get to those and from you, panel@wamc.org, after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. And to our discussion this morning, we are talking about a school shooting that took place in Georgia yesterday, Winder, Georgia. And a 14-year-old student is accused of killing four people with a military-style rifle at the high school and was questioned about online threats last year, according to the FBI. We do have a lot of comments on this, and I want to get to as many as we can before the top of the hour, and then after the news, we'll move on to other topics. Catherine says, I just read that one. Richard is who I wanted to go to. Richard.
Joe, can I break in and say
I'm doing bad at cold.
Joe Biden said students are learning how to duck and cover instead of read and write, and it made me wonder, like, why am I not seeing what Vice President Harris is saying on this? I mean, maybe she said something, but I didn't see it.
Oh, she did. I saw coverage of it yesterday.
Turk writes, so the FBI visits the home of a potential threat, interviews the person of interest, and his dad finds nothing suspicious and leaves? Seriously? How about a follow-up, a discussion with his school teachers, principal, or counselor? Dare I say, it does take a village. That from Turk. Then we go to Vicky. During the FBI questioning, I read that there were hunting rifles in the house and the son did not have free access to them. Since the parents were made aware of their child's problem, did they arrange for the child to get help? Why wasn't social services involved with the family? I agree that parents should be accountable, but there needs to be a system for help. Yes, I am tired of having this conversation. Policies need to be in place. And that from Vicky.
I agree, Joe. And the great question is, did the whomever spoke with the family, did they ask, you know, to take inventory of the firearms, and did they pass out the appropriate trigger locks? I mean, what a simple measure. And if it wasn't taken, why don't we make sure we do that every time next time?
Law enforcement in Georgia may not have that right.
No, I'm not saying force. I'm literally saying hand them trigger locks.
Oh, no, I understand. I'm just saying, like, could they? I don't know. I'm guessing that law enforcement in Georgia cannot ask, or they can ask, but they have no right to presume that they can take an inventory of firearms.
But there was some discussion that the authorities knew there were firearms.
Yes, yes.
We should find out in this case, did an authority, whomever, simply come to the house with a box and say, from what we understand, this will do it. If this isn't enough, give us a ring.
Yeah.
Have a nice day. Right. And if we didn't do that, we should do that every time we interview a child who's made threats about gun violence who lives in a home with firearms.
I agree, Mark, that there are things that we should be doing immediately once we think that there's, you know, suspicious behavior. But I think we have to back way up. It's not just about mental health services after we've identified that somebody's this troubled. Why are we getting to this place? That's a broader question. Like, how unhappy, how miserable, how difficult does the future look to a child like this that they would take an action like this?
Yeah, it's a topic for another day that some panelists have encouraged this panel to take up. Why is it young American males are so disillusioned? What's happening and what do we need to do about it? There's a lot there.
There really is a lot there. Okay, let's go to this letter from Jeff. It's not easy to just get mental health treatment, quote unquote. It took months to get my son help. After COVID, our schools brought in a contracted agency to provide services. We immediately signed up our son, doing the whole half-hour intake and insurance stuff on the phone. My son was severely depressed and anxious and really needed help. When we showed up for the first set, we were devastated to find they had no record of the intake. It was 3 weeks before we could get back in. The counselor was new and effective and missed half the appointments due to trainings. We finally found good counseling through a private agency, but when his symptoms advanced to include serious suicidal ideation, they dumped him. We had to start over again. More and more failure of the system, you all say, should be serving him. It's a horrible experience to endure, especially for the child who needs help and keeps getting failed. Side note, owners of guns should be 100% responsible in how they get used. Then we can see how, quote, responsible gun ownership works as a solution. That is from Jeff. It's a great letter. It's really hard. It's really hard. I would argue, and I have some knowledge of this because my brother works in this field in North Carolina, it's in the South, it's worse. I mean, finding a mental health professional, there are I think most counties within the state of North Carolina do not have a mental health office or setup, other than even finding a psychiatrist or a psychologist is very difficult in most counties. And that obviously is a huge, huge problem.
I agree with the listener. It's a month's wait, you know, can be multi-month's wait here. It's very hard to find. It's almost impossible to find anything in person. The whole field has shifted to online, and that doesn't work for everybody. So it's very challenging to get the support that you need. And we don't have enough professionals working in that area. They're probably not compensated enough. And I was just looking over a bill, actually, for one of my children's mental health sessions. It was a $500 bill for a one-hour session, 45 minutes, actually. And our copay was $50. $500 for 45 minutes? What are we doing?
Let's go to Emmy, who says, I cringe when Joe said that we have one candidate who firmly believes in the Second Amendment. That plays right into the hands of those who say the Democrats and progressives do not believe in the Second Amendment. I will just say that I was being cautious in my language because I didn't want to say it was like pro-gun or pro-shooter, although. But I do think, I mean, that is what he talks about, right? So, okay. But I understand the point of how it makes the Democrats.
I got to tell you, this election, on about 99% of the topics, you kind of know, given where you stand, which one to pick. And I don't think on gun safety it's that tough to figure out if you want more gun safety in this country where you vote.
So this listener is saying the summation of the letter is that it's important for you not to make it sound as if the former president is the only candidate who believes in the Second Amendment.
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay, that is fair. All right. Thank you, Emmy. We go to...
We can have the Second Amendment and still have reasonable regulation of guns. I mean, the two are not counter to each other.
Alan says Japan has access to the same video games that we do, and they have a dozen or less gun deaths per year. Why? Common sense gun regulations. The end. Cynthia, I am gratified that the panel is discussing the moral dilemma of charging the 14-year-old as an adult. I was horrified listening to the sheriff revealing mere hours after the shooting that he would be so charged and referencing his hate and evil. Someone please help me reconcile the fact that we hold a minor incapable of voting, incapable of driving a car, incapable of joining the military, incapable of using tobacco legally, presumably because they lack the maturity to responsibly carry out these functions. How in God's name does a troubled child possess that maturity? That from Cynthia. Robin says some of the commentary on today's roundtable seems odd. Probably say that most days. Making sure every firearm purchaser contributes toward insurance to cover cleanup or counseling after a shooting does not help prevent these tragedies. Executing a 14-year-old student does not help anything. Why aren't you talking about red flag laws, universal background checks, and assault weapons bans? I think we were, but okay. Even if it took 100 years to get rid of all AR-15s, why not start now?
I don't disagree with that last point. And on the point about insurance not solving it, actually it would. Because if it were, if the insurance bill that came along with an AR-15 was appropriate, it would make it more expensive. And when you make things more expensive, they are less, the demand falls. So it actually is a direct way of trying to putting in an insurance policy like that is actually a direct way to try and limit the number. It's not as effective as an entire ban, but we should at least start to fairly reflect the risks associated with
these. That's another layer of accountability, too. Like, we haven't been able to totally figure out with our legal system how to do accountability for these, which is why some people think when we suggest there's a problem with the system, then we're saying the individual shouldn't be held accountable. That's not the case at all. You can do both. But another layer of accountability, financial accountability, would strengthen the entire system.
One more letter, and then we're going to take a break and we'll move on to other topics on the other side. Zachary says, I agree calling a 14-year-old evil is wrong. What the boy did was wrong. But when someone commits such an act, I cannot help but feel that the system has failed that child. Society has failed another sad, lonely person so badly that he turned to violence. We need to teach empathy at a younger age. That from Zachary. We will take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation, new topics with our terrific panel. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. First News with Ray Graff. Can we step out of the wreckage yet, my friend? Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. It is the 5th of September. We have been talking about the school shooting in Georgia. We're going to move on and talk about other issues. One that we touched on yesterday, we didn't touch on it. We spent a good deal of time talking about the secrets of an unassuming New York official accused of working for China. Linda Sun, a former deputy chief of staff to Governor Kathy Hochul, used her growing influence to push the interests of the Chinese government, according to U.S. prosecutors. This from the New York Times, months after a low-level aide in the administration of Governor Andrew Cuomo returned from a visit to China in 2019, she got a curious inquiry from federal investigators. The FBI wanted to know about the nature of the trip that the aide Linda Sun had taken. The interaction in 2020 was one of the first known instances of governmental interest in Ms. Sun's activities. But according to a federal indictment unsealed on Tuesday, it was not the last. In February of 2023, Ms. Sun was interviewed by the state's Office of the Inspector General about her unauthorized procurement of official proclamations from the governor's office, according to the indictment.
And when Ms. Sun was fired by Governor Kathy Hochul's administration weeks later, state officials' suspicions surrounding Ms. Sun were reported immediately to law enforcement, according to the governor. Before her dismissal, even as questions were repeatedly raised, Ms. Sun continued to use her positions in state government to benefit the People's Republic of China and its Communist Party in exchange for millions of dollars in benefits, according to prosecutors with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Brooklyn. How does that happen, Malia?
Well, I want to make sure I'm clear that I'm offering an explanation and not an excuse, right? So the explanation is that this is not a surprising turn of events. It's not surprising that states such as China and Russia engage in this behavior. This is part of what states do that doesn't often rise to the level of news, but we have large federal agencies like the FBI that are dedicated to watching these things, investigating them, and guarding against them on a daily basis. So when it rises to the level of news, then suddenly we become aware that there's this whole apparatus that's trying to protect us from these things on a daily basis. And they have been discovering other nefarious events. So with regard to China itself, people remember last April, there was a secret police station that the Chinese were operating in Lower Manhattan that the FBI found and investigated and shut down. Earlier than that, in 2022, there was a Chinese man who was a Tiananmen protester, and he came to the United States in 92. His name is Xiong Yan, and he got a divinity degree from a U.S. seminary. He joined the army. Was a pastor in the army, and now he's a pastor at a church, and he decided to run for Congress. And Chinese, even, you know, this is 1992, he left China, and the Chinese government still so concerned about a Tiananmen protester that they tried to sabotage this guy's, a true American patriot who served in the army, was a pastor in the army in Iraq, and wanted to run for Congress in Queens, and they sabotaged his campaign. So This is a pattern of behavior that we've seen from China, and it's known to the people in our government who are trying to protect us from these things, and they're watching and investigating these things on a regular basis. I'm sure we'll hear more. Well, maybe we won't actually. Maybe we won't hear that much more about the background of this, because I'm sure some of these things are classified, given that it's state-level interactions, which is why it was a little bit surprising, more than a little bit surprising, that I heard that Governor Hochul was trying to prevail upon the State Department to expel the China's top diplomat in New York, the consul general, Huang Ping, who has been in that position for a couple of years and was scheduled to rotate out this month anyway. She wanted to expel him because of the actions of Ms. Sun. I'm not sure if her name is pronounced Sun or Sun, but
I've heard both. We've heard with Sun, yeah.
So I am not aware of. I mean, that's not a governor level. These are state level. This is State Department kind of action. And it would be highly unusual to expel an ambassador level, because even though Huang Ping is the consul general in New York, he has held an ambassador position previously before coming to New York. He was China's ambassador to Zimbabwe. He previously served as China's consul general in Chicago. So he's been in the United States many times for a long time. And that would be expelling a diplomat. It is usually reserved for you know, much. I don't want to say this is not a serious situation. It is, but that's really amping up the level of hostility when what's happening is sort of normal level statecraft and China taking advantage of access. It's unclear if Ms. Sun, if she was a Chinese agent all along, or if she was pursuing her own interests and then the Chinese realized, oh, here's someone who has gotten herself into a position of some influence, so let's see if we can co-opt her. I mean, so both things happen. And I also want to point out, because in the news this morning as well, is the influence that Russia has been buying on U.S. airwaves from U.S. influencers. And a lot of the U.S. Influencers who have found themselves named or rolled up in the say, I'm a victim too, I didn't realize, you know, you don't have to, you can be an agent of a foreign government without knowing it. Right? That's something that we all should keep in mind is if you Russia, China, Iran, these are countries that want to see the United States internally divided, at odds, weakened, unable to project leadership and strength around the world. And so of course they're going to exploit vulnerabilities, they're going to exploit these divisions. And if you can express your own opinions, but if it happens to be an opinion that Iran agrees with, maybe they're going to try to amplify your voice, you know, and that might make you an agent of Iran without even knowing it. So it's a very complex issue. It's been going on for a long time. We as just, you know, regular citizens are not going to see sort of the day-to-day investigations that go on, but occasionally things come out like this.
Mark.
Well, I'd like to apologize to the showrunners of the show The Americans. I watched that, and for those who don't know what it was, it was about a couple who was embedded Russian agents. And there were some episodes where they spent a lot of time and money trying to exert what seemed like almost insignificant influence within the United States. and frankly, it rings true in the wake of what we've learned about Chinese efforts. And I fear that we're only catching the tip of the proverbial iceberg. This is a country that is on par with us in terms of its economic prowess, or nearly on par. It's got 1.4 billion citizens, and it's an autocracy, so they get to decide where they spend their resources. And I get the funny feeling they're spending a tremendous amount influencing internal politics in this country in the ways that Malia denoted. I also want to just reach out to the Democrats around Kathy Hochul and then to the Republican Party. To the Democrats around Kathy Hochul, somebody needs to help her get some finesse in her game. This thing yesterday where she said, well, at the request of, and I'm going to paraphrase it, Anthony Blinken, I spoke to the State Department, and I told them they ought to expel this person, and I understand he's no longer available. It's like, whoa, slow your horses there, Governor. You don't take on statecraft that is well above your pay grade and, frankly, your understanding. And she felt, she sort of feels like, it appears to me as if she feels she's responsible for the fact that this person was in her administration. She's trying to make up for it by looking tough, the same sort of toughness that she promulgated when she went down to Brooklyn after becoming governor and promised or stated that the shooting stops here. And then Buffalo happened, and she realized that she's only a governor, not a deity or a operative in the State Department. And to the Republicans, I just want to ask the following. Lee Zeldin took a shot at Kathy Hochul and came close. Next time around, appoint somebody who's reasonable, not a J6 acolyte, and you got a good chance at changing who's the governor of this state.
I want to go back to what Malia was saying about you may not know that you're an agent. And in fact, when I first saw the news break, I was like thinking that this woman, this Linda's son, didn't know, may not have known that she was an agent.
She clearly knew, yeah.
But she clearly knew because she went into meetings in the governor's office on COVID with her phone online, you know, her phone dialed in to Chinese Communist Party officials, and she forged documents and she took other direct actions that are very obvious. But some people may not know, and this leads to the question for me as an elected official who hires people, how do you know, of course, at a low level that China would never care about, but how would you vet these people appropriately? Do we have the tools and capabilities in place to really look at this, especially if somebody is co-opted along the line? We don't do things like polygraph our employees on a regular basis in state government. And I think most of us would think that would be an outrageous act to do. And I also really, in light of the Russian news that broke this morning and last night about Russia buying right-wing influencers to promote their product and their materials, wondered how do we counteract that? And do we have the self-reflection in place as individuals who are sharing materials to actually say, what is this we're sharing? And I found that several years ago when RT, which is a Russian media platform that no longer publishes in the United States, I had friends sharing their stuff. And I said, do you know what RT is? And they would say no. And I'm like, please go research that. So we as individuals and we as elected officials and governments in general, I don't know that we have the tools in place to really monitor this.
Well, I will say, so as a member of the military, and I don't know if this is true in the other services, but at least in the Army, every year I'm required to go through some like counter-espionage training. And it's an online course, but it's very effective. And so like something like that, you don't have to polygraph. I mean, that would be, as you said, like onerous and not really effective. But what this training trains us to do is to look for indicators. And one indicator usually isn't sufficient, right? I mean, if someone, let's take the example of Linda Sun. So Linda Sun apparently started wearing a lot of designer clothes. It's like, you wonder, like, okay, so she's displaying some unusual, and she's visiting China more often than usual. So seems like she has the money to buy these clothes and go overseas. So that in itself, there could be an explanation for that. Maybe, you know, she came into some money or her husband got a better paying job or something. But you take that in conjunction with, well, she is going to China a lot more often. And like, what are some of the other indicators? Like, is she spending late nights in the office by herself, you know, for unexplained reasons? Is she looking at files? I mean, like,
how about she was advocating for Hochul to take Uyghurs out of her speech on Chinese New Year?
So that's like, this is a very blatant example. But the idea is officials at every level, even at, you know, the county level, you can think of what are some of the indicators that I would be concerned about if someone were displaying. And one, you have to be very careful, of course, about protecting people's civil rights. So you're not surveilling people, but you notice these things. If someone starts wearing a lot of expensive designer clothes to the office, you don't have to be surveilling them to notice that. And so, you're just on watch for a bunch of indicators showing up, over, you know, a pattern of behavior.
If they say we had duck again last night.
Prepared by the Chinese consulate.
The other
sent to
thing
our home.
I think it's very important to say, as Mark pointed, there are 1.4 billion people in China. These are the policies and practices of the Chinese government. There are a lot of people of Chinese and other Asian countries' heritage in this country who are patriots and great Americans. And every time something like this happens, there tends to be like this anti-Asian backlash. And it's so important that we not do that, because we have people like Xiongyan, that congressional candidate who protested Tiananmen Square and came to the U.S. and joined the army. I mean, he's a wonderful example of the kind of people that we welcomed into this country from around the world. And it's, we just want to be very clear to just the way in our country, we distinguish between our government and ourselves, that we don't lump all Chinese people in with the actions of their government.
And I don't think for one second that the United States doesn't do the same thing. I bet you anything that we have, you know, people in other governments that we are talking to, that we are sharing information with, that we are expecting to pass information back. I have no doubt that we do.
Yeah, I don't think we're as effective, though, because we don't summarily execute people we so much as suspect of crimes like that. And we don't have the surveillance state that China does. So I suspect it's a lot harder. I mean, look at Iran, for instance, right? It's a lot harder for us to sort of, I don't doubt that we've got some visibility, but I think it's a lot less than, say, the Chinese or the Iranians have into us because of the different natures of our society and of civil rights and the rest of it. I'd also say, Malia, I also think we have to be careful that there might well be people in the United States who support the Chinese government and its
too.
Way of doing things and aren't on the dole for it.
Right.
And honestly think, you know, they look at our society and they look at the news this morning in Georgia and they say there are better ways of organizing communities, and that doesn't mean that they're spies or even our enemies.
It's striking that I don't put a lot of faith in polls, but there is a recent poll that said, you know, 95% of Chinese people have a favorable view of their government. Now, it's, you know, maybe it's, even if it's half that, it's still a lot more than we have in the United States. So,
but we're allowed to express our dissent here.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
All right. Let's go to another story before we go to a break here at the bottom of the hour. Liz Cheney has announced that she is going to vote for Kamala Harris. That is different than saying she is going to endorse Kamala
Harris. I agree,
Joe.
I saw the news saying that everywhere was saying she endorsed Harris, and I wrote a question here. Is that an endorsement? That's what I wrote in my book.
I mean, I guess it is, but at the same time, it's not. I think an endorsement indicates that you're going to go out on the road, you're going to speak up, you're going to be a part of the campaign in some way or open yourself to that. This was an interview, and she said that she could not vote for Donald Trump, and she would vote for Kamala Harris. I guess my question that I have down in the margins here for all of you, for the three panelists, is so what does that do? Like, what? How big of a deal is this?
I think it's a big deal, especially since the Trump campaign immediately shared video of Cheney stating that Harris was to the left of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And I think that reverses what they, you know, the impact is reversed of what they expect. If I were a conservative Republican and I saw that video of Cheney saying that Kamala Harris is to the left of Bernie Sanders, yet she is voting for Harris now anyway to save democracy, that would be meaningful to me. So I do think it's meaningful. I think it's going to speak to some people who are on the margins. There are a lot of disaffected Republicans who are not satisfied with Trump as a candidate, and this opens the door wider for them to come to the Harris camp.
I remember. So there was some talk before Kamala Harris chose Tim Walz as her running mate that I know some people in the wishful thinking category are like, Liz Cheney should. So the fact that we're having this question, like, does her announcement mean that she's endorsing? And it seems kind of unclear. To me, it looks like Liz Cheney is supporting Harris, but she's not gunning for a role in a Harris administration if Harris wins.
Yeah, look, Liz Cheney, for instance, is firmly pro-life. I think her last scorecard from the Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America was an A. So I understand why somebody like that, and I'm sure in her case it's a heartfelt belief. So I understand why someone like that won't, quote-unquote, endorse Vice President Harris. I applaud her for taking the practical stance of saying, I'm actually going to vote for her, as opposed to some of those more mealy-mouth approaches of saying, well, I'm not going to vote for either of them, basically conservatives who can't stomach what happened on J6 and everything around it. So I think she's to be lauded for taking an intellectually honest approach to how she's going to act. Does it make any difference? Well, she lives in Wyoming, so the answer is no. Because if she were in swing state, that one vote might have made a difference. I don't think she's bringing anybody of significance with her. Disappointingly, there are far too many Americans who don't see the threat of sitting down and playing chess again with a guy who, when we mated him last time, tried to overthrow the board. And now he wants to play the same game again and has already told us, well, if you get me to mate, you know, it'll only be because of your subterfuge, and I may have to try and toss the board again. I can't believe so many Americans are willing to lean into his left hook once again, but they are. So I think the net effect of Liz Cheney's pronouncement is exactly zero.
Hey, I just want to apologize for something I just said, because I don't think Liz Cheney is gunning for a position in the Harris administration. And, like, nobody, like, we didn't pause. I didn't think until, you know, after Mark started speaking, and then I, like, you know, we just got finished talking about this horrible mass shooting, and, like, this word came out of my mouth, and it's a phrase that we use commonly, and I didn't notice it in the moment. And
I had the same problem this morning with the word triggered. It's very much a part of,
we live in a gun culture.
You have to think about it and of what it means.
So I did not mean to be insensitive or whatever.
Correct.
And I mean, it's just, yeah. So
Liz Cheney's life is at risk here. I just want to be clear. I think that, you know, Trump on January 6th called for, said we have to get rid of weak Congress people, the ones that aren't any good, like Liz Cheney. And he went on Truth Social and said, with respect to the select committee that she was co-chairing, re-truth if you want military tribunals. I mean, this is a really scary thing happening, and we're not really talking about that. And I think she sees that risk, not just for her own self, but for everyone in the country.
I think that's worth pointing out. You remember Romney in his book said that he spent $6,000 a month on the safety of he and his family, and I don't think they exactly live like near the street in an apartment building either. So, yeah, that's a real risk, and not everyone can afford to insure themselves against it.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up and hear the closing thoughts of our panel. We welcome you. We'll be right back after this.
Building in the hay.
Listening to the music of Goose this morning, Goose playing at SPAC in Saratoga Springs on the 6th and the 7th. That's tomorrow night and Saturday night. You can find out more by going to SPAC.org and a playlist posted online at WAMC.org/roundtable. We welcome you and your comments as we finish up our time together this morning. I thought we'd spend just a few minutes sort of highlighting as we come closer and closer to Election Day 2024, of just checking in daily of where we are in the race and try to keep track of some of the twists and the turns. The debating over the rules of the presidential debate next Tuesday appears to be over. The microphones for Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump will be muted when it is not their turn to speak. But on Wednesday night during a Fox News town hall, Mr. Trump questioned whether the debate on ABC would be fair. He insisted without evidence that Ms. Harris was going to get the questions in advance. I would just like to point out that he has been against, even before Kamala Harris took over for Joe Biden, when Biden was still, when this debate was talked about and settled, with Biden as the candidate, Trump was complaining about it being biased against him. So that there's that. The microphone rule was in place during Mr. Trump's previous debate with President Biden, but once Ms. Harris became the Democratic nominee, her aides wanted the microphones unmuted in an effort to goad Mr. Trump into interruptions. While Mr. Trump insisted that it didn't matter to him, he also said the agreement was that it would be the same as it was the last time. On Wednesday, Ms. Harris's team begrudgingly agreed to the full set of rules proposed by ABC, including muted microphones. Also on Wednesday, former representative, as we mentioned, Liz Cheney, told students at Duke University that she would vote for Ms. Harris. Also, other things. Trump Town Hall, the event taped earlier in Pennsylvania, was hosted by Sean Hannity, started at 9 p.m. on Fox News. The interview portion with Mr. Hannity is running, ran last night, and the audience questions are set to be aired tonight. As far as courting business, Ms. Harris on Wednesday rolled out a series of economic proposals, including 28% tax on investment income for wealthy individuals that is far lower than the rate proposed by President Biden. The proposals, which include an expanded tax break for startups, mark her biggest policy move away from Mr. Biden since taking over the top of the Democratic ticket. The appearance was intended to help Ms. Harris court the business community. Mark, what do you make of that courting of the business community, and then secondarily, the idea that this is a shift away from the Biden policy?
I think it is a shift in announced policy. But if you think about how tax law gets enacted and actually practiced in this country, it has to go through obviously the legislative branch. Last time I checked, so I think the practical effect of her targeting a different rate is pretty insignificant. I think it's clear she's trying to tell business interests, particularly those who are well-heeled and still contributing to campaigns, come on in, the water will be better. than you would have expected it under Joe Biden. So I think it's pretty clear what she's doing. I forgot the second question you asked me. I'm sorry. But I have an agenda I'd like to talk about anyway. Okay. It's related to Trump, though, and the microphone's being closed. You know, and this flip-flopping he did over the weekend around abortion, where he was for and against the restriction at 6 weeks in Florida, I think we ought to just call out what he does and look at it really carefully. He actually sometimes in the same sentence will take opposite views of the same thing. If you remember during the debate with Joe Biden, if he would denounce the Trump boy, the Proud Boys, he actually, if you listen to the tape or see a transcript, he actually said, yes, what would you like me to say? So if back in the day, if you're was it Kathy or Katie McElhaney? She can say, well, he clearly denounced the Proud Boys because when Joe Biden said, would you? He said, yes. And then he goes on to say, well, I'd like you boys to stand back and stand by, which we all know isn't really a denouncement. But what he does is, if you're the Proud Boys, you read what you want in that statement because you ain't getting anything like that out of the other side. So, too, if you're pro-life, you take the statements you heard over the weekend that you like, you grab hard onto those because you're not getting anything that sounds nearly like that. And I just want to emphasize what a master he is, whether it's accidental or otherwise, at playing that and leaving enough on the table for those who want to support him to do so. It's incredible if you look at the craft that he ploys. No. Plies, thank you.
Plies. P-L-Y-S.
Yeah.
So the other question I asked, though, which is not, I mean, you answered it primarily, but of the article saying the appearance was intended to help Ms. Harris court the business community, effective in that?
I think it's hard to judge, frankly. I wouldn't proffer a response there. I the answer is I don't know. I will say, she's also talking about a more moderate approach to taxing share repurchases, which I would like to go on record as saying the only people who are proponents of taxing share repurchases lack a fundamental understanding of what they are and of corporate finance.
I wish in society we use the word proffer more.
Joe, I hope it's effective with the business community because it's really letting March Gallagher down in a big way. I liked the Biden tax increase. I want to see the 39.6% rate, and now she's taking it to 28. Yes, it has to go through Congress, so we'll see what happens there. And tax legislation is always very controversial and gets changed a lot. But that was disheartening to me. On the other hand, I say to myself, okay, be an adult. You have to accept that we're all trying to meet in the middle to save democracy here, and that's something I'm going to have to accept. I noticed that her tax policy is silent on the SALT tax reduction. That's state and local taxes. I personally would like to see, you know, as a New Yorker, that put back to where it was. I don't think we're ever going to see that. And then I just want to note that I had a friend share on social media that they were very upset about the tax on unrealized gains. And it was a very controversial sort of post appearing. And I said, you realize that applies only to families, you know, people over $100 million. I don't know anybody in that category. I went and checked. She had taken the post down. So this is an example where there's just a tremendous amount of false narrative that's put out there. And I last time I was on the show, I was saying, you know, I'm concerned about Harris putting too much out there because Trump doesn't really put anything out there. And then you can use it to attack the candidate.
Mark, anybody else? All right.
Well, the one thing I'd say about tax policy and what you say getting enacted, just ask Christian Sinema how that works out. I think we all ought to keep a close eye on her post-congressional career. She saved the financial sponsor group billions of dollars. I got a funny suspicion she's going to be okay as an ex-congressperson.
All right. I wanted to, let's see, was there another thing that I wanted to get to here? There is. I just want to see if we have time for it. Robert Kennedy on News Nation.
What?
Sorry. That's not where we thought you were going.
He's accepted a position in the Hochul administration.
That he is planning a Make America Healthy Again tour of battleground states as a surrogate of the Trump campaign. Since he dropped his independent presidential bid, Kennedy has endorsed his former rival while also emphasizing his own policies on health and the environment. It remains uncertain if Kennedy will be appointed to a position related to his priorities in a hypothetical second Trump term, but he recently joined Trump's transition team. While Kennedy had sought to remove his name from ballots in battleground states, a judge in Michigan said he would have to remain on the ballot there. That is interesting, too, that you...
Can you imagine him as Secretary of Health and Human Services?
No, he's gonna be the head of what's like the head of phys ed, that position, head of health.
Yeah, like health class.
Lift the bear carcass up and put it down.
His Make America Healthy Again, I assume it includes like don't get vaccinated. It's like what right. not to do. I mean,
do the
like,
opposite.
Yeah, do the opposite of what like doctors around the country are recommending.
What would Kennedy say about the polio vaccination efforts in Gaza?
Yeah. I got to tell you, I'd much rather see Ralph Nader doing that tour. If you want to talk about people who used to be third-party candidates, there's a guy I may not agree with, but I respect. I can't think I say the same thing about Kennedy. I heard your interview with him, by the way. It was very good.
Sounded good, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it was great.
He's a regular listener of the program and very active and thoughtful. So
you're talking about Ralph Nader now,
yes,
right?
Yes. Yes. No, I... good catch. That's right. And finally, I don't think we have time to do this. I was just going to ask a general question about ceasefire and talking about the confusions and what that is. And I guess, Malia, I'll just ask you quickly of what you make of where we are right now in this and where you think both Netanyahu is going and what the United States can ultimately accomplish.
I think Netanyahu is running up against increasing opposition within Israel. I mean, but I don't think that's going to dissuade him. I don't think, despite the fact that there's more and more tension around this, that Israel hasn't yet accomplished its objectives, that they're going to change their course, or that American policy is going to change dramatically under whichever candidate wins.
That man has literally been reported as saying one thing in English to the American media and another thing in Hebrew to the Israeli media. That's all you need to know about what he's up to.
All right. We will end there on this Thursday morning. My thanks to all of you for being so brilliant. Malia Dumont, March Gallagher, and Mark Whitman, I thank you so much. Have a beautiful afternoon. We'll see you soon, and we'll continue with our program after this short break.